Her face was dark. Yes, I said, but who did you get arrested?
No one.
When she looked disbelieving, I realized I had to tell her. They tried to make me kill Seb, the Amarotic. I looked down. And now he's dead. She flinched. Right, she said. See you later, then. Liz, I said, please listen. You don't... She yanked the curtain across her door, cutting me off. I slid down the wall, drained. I wasn't one of them. Seb. I said his name in my head, trying to coax his spirit from wherever they'd hidden it. But there was nothing from the ether. Not even a twinge. Even with his surname, there was nothing. I had to be missing a name. The boy that had been so dependent on me, so certain that I would save him, was still a stranger to me in death. The curtain seemed to glare at me. Liz must think I was pure scum. I closed my eyes, trying to ignore the dull ache in my thigh. Maybe I could find another pink jacket to exchange information with. But I didn't want to do that. I couldn't trust them. Most of them were murderers. Most of them had turned somebody in. If I wanted to talk to someone who wasn't a turncoat, I had to prove to Liz that she could trust me. With an effort that left me coated in sweat, I pulled myself up and headed for the food shack. I might find Julian there. Not that he'd want to talk to me either, but he might give me a chance. A light caught my eye. A stove. A group of performers were smoking in a tiny lean-to, slumped on their sides, snatching at the air. I asked her again. Tilda was among them, her head propped on a cushion, her white tunic filthy and crumpled, like a used tissue. I groped in my gilet for the green capsule I'd taken. Minding my leg, I knelt beside her. Tilda? Her eyes cracked open. What's matter? I brought the pill. Hold on, still raining. Give me a minute, doll. Maybe two. Or five. She rolled onto her stomach, racked with silent laughter. Dreamscape's gone all purple. Are you real? I waited for the aster to wear off. Tilda spent a solid minute laughing, flushed to the roots of her hair. I could sense the wildness in her aura, the way it jerked and shifted with the drug. The other voyeurs showed no signs of wanting to wake up. With shaking hands, Tilda rubbed her face and nodded. Okay, I'm dethroned. Where's the pill? I handed it to her. She looked at it from every angle, ran her finger over it, testing the texture, split it in half, crushed one half between her fingers, smelled the residue, tasted it. Your keeper's out again, I said. She's out a lot. She handed me the remnants of the pill. It's herbal. Couldn't tell you which herb. Do you know anyone who could tell me? There's a jerry shop in here. The guy that sold me the aster might be able to help you. Password Specchio. I'll see him. I stood. I'll leave you to your aster. Thanks. Slater. She collapsed back into the cushion. I wondered what Sewell would do if he found them. It took me a while to find the jerry shop. The rookery had many rooms, most of which were occupied by groups of two or three. They spent their days in cramped shacks, huddled around a paraffin stove, and slept on sheets that reeked of damp and urine. They ate what they could find. If they found nothing, they starved. They stayed together for two reasons, because there was no room for them to do otherwise, and because of the bitter cold in the city. There were no hygiene facilities and no medical supplies, except for what they obtained through theft. This was where you came to die. The jerry shop was hidden behind a series of thick curtains. You had to know where to look. I only found it after interrogating a Harley for its whereabouts. She seemed reluctant to tell me, warning me of blackmail and high prices, but pointed me in the right direction. Guarding the shop was the Jilker boy I'd seen at the oration. He sat on a cushion, playing with dice. No sign of his white tunic. He must have failed his test. What use did the Rephaim have for a Jilker? Hello, I said. Hi. A pure, sweet note. a Jilker voice. Can I see the pawnbroker? What's the password?
Specchio.
The voice did. His right eye was thick with paste, infected. He pulled the curtains aside and I went through. Londonderry shops were usually small, unlicensed places in the bad parts of the central cohort. There were lots in the chapel too, over in 2-6. This was no different. The pawnbroker had set up shop in a kind of tent, made from the sort of drapes Liz used in her performances. Lit by a single paraffin lamp, half the space had been turned into a house of mirrors. The pawnbroker sat on a battered leather armchair, staring into the spotted glass. He was a grey-haired man with too much of a full stomach to be a performer. The mirrors betrayed his speciality, catopromancy. When I entered, he raised a monocle to one eye and looked at my reflection. He had the misty eyes of a seer that had seen too much.
I don't believe I've seen you before.
In my mirrors or my shop. Bone season 20, I said.
I see. Who owns you?
Arcturus Mazartum. I was sick of that name, hearing it, saying it.
My, my.
He patted his stomach. So you're his tenant. What's your name?
16-19-16.
Your real name?
I no longer remember it, but the performers call me Duckett. If you prefer to use real names.
I do. I bent to look at his stock. Most of the items were Numa. Cracked hand mirrors, glass bottles of water, bowls and cups, pearls, bags of animal bones, cards and shoe stones. Then there were the plants. Aster, briar, sage, thyme, other burning herbs. There were more practical items too, essential for survival. I looked through the pile. Sheets, limp cushions, matches, a pair of tweezers, rubbing alcohol, aspirin and oxytetracycline, cans of Sterno, a dripper bottle of fusidic acid, bandages and disinfectants. I picked up an old tinderbox.
Where did you get all this?
Here and there.
I presume the refs don't know about it. He smiled, just slightly.
So how does this illegal shop work?
Well, say you're an osteomancer. You would require bones to supplement your clairvoyance. If the bones were confiscated, you would have to find more.
He indicated a bag marked Common Rat.
I would give you a task to do. I might ask you to bring more supplies, or to carry a message for me. The more valuable the item you needed, the more dangerous the task. If you managed it, I would give you the bones to keep. For a limited loan, you would have to bring me a certain number of Numa, which I would return to you when you returned the item. A simple but effective system.
Didn't sound like a conventional Jerry shop, which loaned money in exchange for pawned items.
What do you charge for information?
That depends on the information you seek.
I put the remaining half of the pill in front of him.
What's this?
He peered at it. He dropped his monocle, picked it up. His thick fingers were shaking.
For this, he said, I would give you anything you like from the shop, free of charge.
I frowned. You want to keep it?
Oh, yes. This is very valuable.
He placed the half in his palm.
Where did you get this?
Information costs, Mr. Duckett.
If you bring me more of these, I will never charge you anything. Take whatever you like. One item per pill.
Tell me what it is or no deal.
Two items.
No.
Information is dangerous. One can't put a price on it.
He held the pill near the paraffin lamp.
I can tell you that it is a herbal capsule, and that it is harmless. Is that enough?
Two items in exchange for the pills. Items like these could save lives in the rookery.
Three, I said, and we've got a deal. Excellent. You are a shrewd businesswoman.
He steepled his fingers.
What else are you?
Occultomancer.
It was my standard lie. A test of competence, in a way. I like to see whether or not they'd believe me.
Duckett chuckled.
You're not a soothsayer.
If I was sighted, I think you'd be in the other end of the spectrum. Yours is a hot aura, like embers.
He tapped his fingers on a mirror. We might have another interesting season this year. I tensed. What? Nothing, nothing, just talking to myself. Best way to keep one's sanity after 40 years. A smile tempted his mouth. Tell me, what do you think of the warden? I put the tinderbox back on the table. I'd have thought it was obvious, I said. Not at all. There are a variety of opinions here. Duckett ran his thumb over the lens of his monocle. The blood consort is considered by many to be the most attractive of the Rephaim. Maybe you think so. I find him repulsive. I held his gaze. I'll take my items. He sat back in his seat. I picked out a sternocan, a few aspirin, and the fusidic acid. Nice doing business with you, he said. Miss Mahoney. Paige Mahoney. I turned my back on him. If you prefer to use real names. I walked out of the den. His eyes stung my back. Those questions had felt like an interrogation. I hadn't said anything wrong, I was sure. I'd said exactly what I thought about Warden. Why Duckett wanted me to say anything otherwise, I had no idea. On my way out, I tossed the fusidic acid to the Jilker. He looked up at me with a tilted head. For your eye, I said. He blinked. I kept on walking. When I reached the right shack, I rapped my knuckles on the wall outside. Liz? No reply. I knocked again. Liz, it's Paige. The curtain was pulled back. Liz was carrying a small lantern. Leave me alone, she said, her voice thick and embittered. Please, I don't talk to pinks or reds. I'm sorry, I just don't. You'll have to find other jackets, okay? I didn't kill Seb. I offered the sterno and the aspirin. Look, I got these from Duckett. Can I just talk to you? She looked from the items to my face. Her forehead creased and her lips pursed. Well, she said, you'd better come in. I didn't cry when I told her about the test. I couldn't. Jax hated tears. You're a ruthless street Dracino, darling. Do act like one, there's a good dolly. Even here, where he could never get to me, I felt that he watched my every move. Still, the thought of Seb's broken neck made me sick. I couldn't forget the shock in his eyes, the scream of my name. I sat in silence once I'd told the story, keeping my stiff leg stretched out in front of me. Liz handed me a steaming glass. Drink this. You're going to have to keep your strength up if you want to avoid Nishira. She sat back. She knows what you are now. I sipped. It tasted of mint. My eyes were hot and my throat still ached, but I wouldn't cry for Seb. It felt disrespectful to cry with Liz sitting next to me. Her face was swollen, her neck bruised by fingers and her shoulder dislocated. Yet she still put my welfare above hers. You're part of the family now, sister, she said, and treated my brand one-handed with a warm poultice. The raw burn in my skin was easing, but she said it would definitely scar. That was the point. To remind me, every day, whom I belonged to. Julian was asleep under a discolored sheet. His keeper had gone to meet with her family, the Kerton. I'd given him some aspirin before he drifted off. His nose looked a bit better. He'd come looking for me after my no-show at dawn, and Liz had taken him in. The two of them had patched up the shack as best they could, but the place was like an icebox. Still, Liz had invited me to stay for the whole night, and I had every intention of doing just that. I needed to get away from Maudlin. Liz cracked open the sterno with an old tin opener. Thanks for guessing this. Haven't seen Canteep for a while. She took out a match and lit the jellied alcohol. A clean blue flame appeared. You got this from Duckett? For a price. What did you give him? One of my pills. Liz raised an eyebrow. Why would he want one of those? Because I get a pill no one else gets. No idea what it is. If you can use them to bribe Duckett, they're worth keeping. His tasks are risky. He makes people go into the residences and steal for him. More often than not, they get caught. She winced and reached for her shoulder. I took the sterno from her hand and placed it between us.
Gomesa did this, I said.
He gets bored of the cards after a while. Doesn't always like what they show him. She lay on her back, pulling the pillow under her neck.
It doesn't matter. I don't see him very much. I don't think he's even in the city most of the time.
Were you his only human?
That's why he hates me. I was in exactly the same situation as you, taken in by a ref that had never chosen a human before. He thought I had potential, thought I could be one of the best bone grubbers in Shiel 1.
Bone grubbers?
It's what we call the red jackets. He thought I'd earn that colour. I disappointed him.
How?
He asked me to do a reading for one of the Harleys. They thought he was a traitor, that he tried to run. I knew it was true. The reading would have incriminated him. I refused to do it.
I didn't want to do it. She still saw what I was.
I rubbed my temple.
And now Seb's dead too.
Amorotics die all the time here. He would have been bones whatever you did.
She sat up again.
Come on, let's eat. She reached over to her wooden chest. I stared at what was inside. A packet of coffee granules, cans of beans, 4 eggs.
How did you get those?
I found them.
Where?
One of the Amorotics hid them near his residence. Leftovers from the bone season supplies. Liz took out an iron pot and filled it with water from a bottle.
There, bleat like greens.
She pushed the pot over the sterno. How are you holding up, Jules?
Our voices must have woken him.
He pushed off the sheet and sat cross-legged.
Better.
He pressed his nose with his fingers.
Thanks for the meds, Paige.
I nodded.
When do you take your test?
No idea. Eludra's supposed to be teaching us about subliming, but she spends most of her time kicking us around.
Subliming?
Turning normal objects into pneuma. Those batons we were using the other night, when you came to see me. They were sublimed. Anyone can use them, not just soothsayers.
What do they do?
They exert some control over the nearest spirits, but they can't be used to see the ether.
So they're not really pneuma.
Still dangerous? Liz said. Rotis can use them. The last thing we need is an ethereal weapon Sion can use.
Julian shook his head.
Sion would never use pneuma. They're repulsed by clairvoyance.
Not by the Rephaim?
I doubt they like the refs, I said.
They're clairvoyant.
They just don't have a choice but to obey, with the emim at the doorstep. The water boiled and steamed. Liz poured it into 3 paper cups and mixed it with coffee. I hadn't smelled coffee in days or weeks.
How long had I been in this place?
Here. She handed 1 cup to me, 1 to Julian.
Where does Eludra keep you, Jules?
A room with no lights. I think it used to be a wine cellar. We sleep on the floor. Felix is claustrophobic, and Elemis is a family. They spend half the day crying, so I don't sleep.
Just get evicted.
It's harsh out here, but not as harsh as it is to have a keeper. We only get fed on if we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Liz sipped from her cup.
Some people can't take it. I had a friend who stayed in here with me, but she begged her keeper for another chance. She's a bone grubber now.
We drank our coffee in silence. Liz boiled the eggs and we ate them straight out of the shell.
I was thinking, Julian said. Can the refs actually go back to wherever they came from?
Liz shrugged.
I guess so.
I just don't understand why they stay. I mean, they weren't always here. What did they do for Aura before they found us?
It might be about the buzzers, I said.
Nashira said they were a parasitic race, didn't she?
Julian nodded.
Think the buzzers took something from them?
Their sanity?
He snorted.
Yeah, or maybe they used to be nice until the buzzers sucked it all out of them.
Liz didn't laugh.
It could be the ethereal threshold, I said.
Nashira did say they appeared when it broke.
I don't think we'll ever know.
Liz sounded tense. It's not like they're going to broadcast it.
Why not? If they're so powerful and we're so feeble, Where's the need for secrecy?
Knowledge is power, Julian said. They have it, we don't.
You're wrong, brother. Knowledge is dangerous.
Liz pulled her knees up to her chin. It was just what Duckett had implied.
Once you know something, you can't get rid of it. You have to carry it. Always.
Julian and I exchanged a glance. Liz had been here for a long time. Maybe we should just take her advice.
Or maybe we shouldn't. Maybe her advice would kill us.
Liz, I said, do you ever think about fighting back?
Every day.
But you don't do it.
I think about gouging out Sewell's eyes with my bare hands, she said it through gritted teeth. I think about shooting Nashira 100 times in every part of her body. I think about stabbing Gomesa in the gullet, but I know they'd kill me first, so I don't do it.
But if you think like that, you'll be stuck here forever, Julian said gently.
Do you want that?
Of course I don't want that. I want to go home.
Whatever that means.
Liz turned her face away. I know what you must think of me. You think I've got no backbone?
Liz, I said, we didn't mean...
Yes, you did. I don't blame you, but let me tell you something if you want knowledge so much. There was a rebellion here during Bone Season 18, back in 2039. The whole human population of Sheol 1 rose up against the Wraiths. The pain in her eyes aged her by decades. They all died. Amaurotics, Voyants, the whole lot. Without the Red Jackets to fight them, the Emim got in and killed them all, and the Wraiths just let them do it. I looked at Julian. He didn't take his eyes off Liz. They said they deserved it, for their disobedience. It was the first thing they told us when we arrived. She ran her cards between her fingers. I know you're both fighters, but I don't want to see you die here. Not like that. Her words silenced me. Julian rubbed a hand over his head, looking at the stove. We didn't go back to the subject of rebellion. We ate the beans, scraping the cans clean. Liz kept her deck on her lap. After a minute, Julian cleared his throat.
Where did you live, Liz?
Before this.
Cradle Hall. It's near Inverness.
What's Sion like up there?
Same as down here, really.
The big cities are all under the same system, but with a smaller security force than London. They're still bound by inquisitorial legislation, like the Citadel.
Why did you come south? I said.
Surely the Highlands were safer for Voyants.
Why does anyone go to Silo?
Work. Money. We need to eat just as much as Amaurotics. Liz drew a sheet around her shoulders. My parents were too afraid to live in central Inverness. Voyants aren't organized there, not like the Syndicate. Dad thought we should try our luck in the Citadel. We spent our savings to get to London. We approached some mine lords, but none of them needed soothsayers. Once the money ran out, we had to busk just to get a dose at night.
And you were caught?
Dad got too ill to go out. He was in his 60s, giving himself all sorts of bugs in the streets. I took his usual stake. A woman approached me and asked for a reading. She ran her thumb over the tops of her cards. I was 9. I didn't realize she was NVD. Julian shook his head.
How long were you in the tower?
4 years. They put me in the waterboard a few times. Tried to make me tell them where my parents were. I said I didn't know. This couldn't be making her feel better. What about you, Julian? I said.
Morden, 4-6.
That's the smallest section, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why the Syndicate doesn't bother with it. I had a little group, but we didn't do mind crime, just the odd seance.
I felt a bitter pang of loss. I wanted my group.
Julian soon succumbed to his exhaustion. The fuel ran lower and lower on the sterno. Liz watched it to the end. I pretended to sleep, but all I could think about was Bone Season 18. So many people must have died. Their families would never have been told. There would have been no trials, no appeals. The injustice of it made me sick. No wonder Liz was so afraid to fight. That was when the siren sounded. Julian jerked awake. The noise cranked and creaked, working itself up like heaving billows, before it let out a scream. My body reacted at once, a prickling at my legs, a thumping heart. Footsteps thundered through the passages. Julian peeled back the rag door. 3 red jackets ran past, one carrying a powerful torch. Liz opened her eyes, perfectly still. "They have knives," Julian said. Liz pushed herself into the corner of the shack. She picked up her deck of cards, scooped an arm around her knees, and put her head down. "You have to go," she said. "No." "Come with us," I said. "Just sneak into one of the residences. You're not safe in... Do you want to get a slating from Aludra? Or the warden?" She glared up at us. "I've been doing this for 10 years. Get out of here." We exchanged glances. We were already late. I didn't know what Warden would do to me, but we both knew how violent Aludra Curtin was. She might just kill him this time. We ducked out of the shack and ran like hell. Chapter 10. The Message. The sirens were still howling when I got back to the residence. 1949-33 only opened the door when I'd knocked for the umpteenth time and shouted my number over the noise. Once she'd established I was human, she hauled me through the door and slammed it behind me, swearing she'd never let me in again if I was that bloody slow to follow basic orders. I left her drawing bolts across the door in agitation, her fingers trembling. The sirens stopped as I reached the cloisters. The MM had not breached the city this time. I scraped back my hair, trying to slow my breathing. After a minute, I made myself look at the doorway, at the winding stone steps. I had to do it. I took another moment to compose myself, then walked up those steps to the tower. His tower. My skin crawled at the thought of sleeping in the same room as him, of sharing his space, his heat, his air. The key was in the door when I arrived. I turned it and stepped quietly onto the flagstones. Not quietly enough. The second I crossed the threshold, my keeper was on his feet. His eyes blazed. "Where have you been?" I kept a tenuous mental guard up. "Outside." "You were told to return here if the siren sounded."
"I thought you meant to Maudlin, not this exact room. You should be more specific."
I could hear the insolence in my voice. His eyes darkened, and his lips pressed into a hard line.
"You will speak to me with a proper respect," he said, "or you will not be allowed outside this room at all."
"You've done nothing to earn my respect." I stared him down. He stared right back at me. When I didn't move or break his gaze, he stalked past me and slammed the door. I didn't flinch.
"When you hear that siren," he said, "you stop what you are doing and return to this room. Do you understand me?"
I just looked at him. He leaned down so his face was at my level.
"Do I need to repeat myself?"
"I'd rather you didn't," I said. I was sure he'd hit me. Nobody could speak to a ref like that. All he did was straighten to his full height.
"We begin your instruction tomorrow," he said. "I expect you to be ready when the night bell rings."
"Instruction for what?"
"For your next jacket."
"I don't want it," I said.
"Then you will have to become a performer. You will have to spend the rest of your life being mocked and spat upon by the red jackets."
He looked me over.
"Do you wish to be a jester? A fool?"
"No."
"Then you had better do as I say."
My throat closed up. Much as I hated this creature, I had good reason to fear him. I recalled his merciless face in the dark chapel, when he'd stood over me and drawn on my aura. Auras were as vital to voyance as blood or water. Without one, I would go into spirit shock and end up dead or insane, wandering around with no connection to the ether. He approached the drapes and pulled them back, revealing the little door beyond them was ajar. The amorotics have cleared the upper floor for you. Unless I say otherwise, you are to keep to it at all times. He paused. You should also know it is forbidden for the two of us to make direct physical contact, except in training, even with gloves. So if you were to come into this room injured, I said, I would leave you to die? Yes.
Liar.
I didn't bite the next words off my tongue quite fast enough. That's one order I'm happy to obey. Warden just looked at me. It almost made me angry. I had little notice he took of my disrespect. He had to have a pressure point. All he did was reach into the drawer and hold out my pills. Take them. I knew there was no point in arguing. I took the pills. Drink this. He handed me a glass. Go to your quarters. You will need to be well rested for tomorrow. My right hand drew into a fist. I was sick of his orders. I should have left him to bleed out. Why the hell had I bandaged his wound? What kind of criminal was I, patching up my enemies? Jax would have laughed himself stupid if he'd seen me. Honeybee, he would have said, you just don't have the sting in you. And maybe I didn't. Yet. I was careful to avoid any contact with Warden when I passed him. I caught his gaze before I stepped into the dark passage. He locked the door behind me. Another winding staircase took me to the upper floor of the tower. I looked at my new abode, a large, bare room. It reminded me of the detainment facility, with a damp floor and barred windows. A paraffin lamp burned on the windowsill, giving little light and even less heat. Beside it was a bed, the type with rails and a lumpy mattress. The sheets were prudish in comparison to the luscious velvet mantles of Warden's four-poster. In fact, the whole room smacked of human inferiority, but anything was better than sharing. I checked every corner and crevice of the room, as I had with the lower floor. No way out, of course. But there was a bathroom. In it was a toilet, a sink, and a few hygiene supplies. I thought of Julian in his dark cellar and thought of Liz, shivering in her shack. She didn't have a bed. She didn't have anything. It wasn't nice in here, but it was far warmer and cleaner than the rookery, and safer. I had stone walls to protect me from the Emim. All she had were tattered curtains. As I hadn't been given night clothes, I stripped to my underwear. There was no mirror, but I could see I was losing weight. Stress, flux poisoning, and a lack of nutritious food were already taking their toll. I dimmed the lamp and slid between the sheets. I hadn't felt tired before, but I found myself dozing and thinking. Thinking of the past, of the strange days that had led me to this place. I thought back to the very first time I met Nick. It was Nick who put Jackson and me in contact. Nick, the man who saved my life. When I was 9, shortly after I came to England, my father and I left London and went south for what he called a business trip. He had to put our names on a waiting list in order for us to leave the Citadel. After months of waiting, we were finally allowed to visit my father's old friend Giselle. She lived on a slanted cobbled hill in a sugar pink house with a roof that hung over the windows. The surrounding land reminded me of Ireland. Open, sumptuous beauty, wild and untamed nature. Everything that Sion had destroyed. At sunset, when my father wasn't looking, I would climb up to the roof and tuck myself against the tall brick chimney. I would stare out at the hills, at the reams of trees under the sky, and I would remember my cousin Finn and the other ghosts of Ireland, and I would miss my grandparents so terribly it hurt. I had never understood why they didn't come with us. But what I wanted was open water. The sea, the wondrous sea, the glittering road that stretched to the free lands. It was over the sea that Ireland waited to bring me home, back to the ashen meadow, to the cloven tree of the rebel's song. My father promised we would see it, but he was too busy with Giselle. They always talked deep into the night. I was too young to understand what the village was really like. Voyants might have been in danger in the Citadel, but they couldn't escape to these idols in the countryside. Far from Archon, small-town Amorotics grew nervous. Suspicions about unnaturalness pervaded those close-knit communities. They made a habit of watching one another, eyes peeled for a crystal ball or shoestone, waiting to call the nearest sign outpost, or take justice into their own hands. A real clairvoyant wouldn't last a day. Even if they did, there was no work. The land needed tending, but not by many hands. They had machines to farm the fields. It was only in the citadel that voyants could make decent money. I didn't like to go far from the house, not without my father. The people talked too much, looked too much, and Giselle talked and looked straight back at them. She was a stern woman, thin and hard-faced, with a ring on every finger and long, string-like veins that bulged from her arms and neck. I didn't like her. But one day, from the rooftop, I spotted a haven, a poppy field, a pool of red beneath the iron sky. Every day when my father thought I was playing upstairs, I would walk to that field and read on my new data pad for hours, watching the poppies nod their heads around me. It was in that field that I had my first true encounter with the spirit world, the ether. At the time, I had no idea I was clairvoyant. Unnaturalness was still a story to a child of nine, a boogeyman with no clear features. I had yet to understand this place. I only knew what Finn had told me, that the bad people over the sea didn't like little girls like me. I was no longer safe. That day, I found out what he'd meant. When I walked onto the field, I sensed the angry presence of the woman. I didn't see her. I felt her. I felt her in the poppies, in the wind. I felt her in the earth and in the air. I stretched my hand out, hoping somehow to work out what it was. And then I was on the ground, and bleeding. It was my first encounter with a poltergeist, an angry spirit that could breach the corporeal world. My savior soon came. A young man, tall and sturdy, with ice-blonde hair and a face that seemed kind. He asked my name. I stammered it. When he saw my tattered arm, he wrapped me in his overcoat and took me to his car. Cyanide was stitched on his shirt. My little body flooded with terror when he took out a needle. "My name's Nick," he said. "You're safe, Paige." The needle went into my skin. It stung, but I didn't cry. The world gradually turned too dark to see. In the dark, I dreamed. I dreamed of poppies struggling from dust. I'd never seen colors when I slept, but now all I could see was the red flowers in the evening sun. They sheltered me, shedding their petals, blanketing my fevered body. When I woke, I was propped up in a bed with white sheets. My arm was bandaged. The pain was gone. The blonde man was beside me. I remember his smile. Just a small smile, but it made me smile back. He looked like a prince. "Hello, Paige," he said. I asked where I was. "You're in a hospital. I'm your doctor." "You don't look old enough to be a doctor," I said, "or scary enough. How old are you?" "I'm 18, still learning." "You didn't sew my arm funny, did you?" He laughed. "Well, I tried my best. You'll have to let me know what you think." He told my father where I was, he said, and he was on his way to see me. I said I felt sick. He said that was normal, but I'd have to rest to make it go away. I couldn't eat just yet, but he'd get me something nice for dinner. He sat with me for the rest of the day, only leaving me to bring sandwiches and a bottle of apple juice from the hospital canteen. My father had told me never to talk to strangers, but I wasn't afraid of this kind, soft-spoken boy. Dr. Nicholas Nygård, a transfer from the Scion Citadel of Stockholm, kept me alive that night. He saw me through the shock of becoming fully clairvoyant. If not for him, it might have been too much for me to stand. My father drove me home a few days later. He knew Nick from a medical conference. Nick was training in the town before he took a permanent position at Sysors. He never said what he'd been doing in the poppy field. While my father waited for me in the car, Nick knelt in front of me and took my hands. I remember thinking how handsome he was, and how perfectly his eyebrows arched over his lovely winter-green eyes. "Paige," he said very quietly, "listen to me.
This is very important. I've told your father you were attacked by a dog.
But it was a lady.
Yes, but that lady was invisible, Sortnose. Some grown-ups don't know about invisible things.
But you do, I said, confident in his wisdom.
I do, but I don't want other grown-ups to laugh at me, so I don't tell them.
He touched my cheek.
You must never, ever tell anyone about her, Paige. Let's make it our secret.
Promise?
I nodded. I would have promised him the world. He had saved my life.
I watched him through the window as my father drove me back to the Citadel. He raised a hand and waved at me. I watched until we turned a corner. I still had scars from the attack. They formed a cluster in the middle of my left palm. The spirit left other cuts, all the way to my elbow, but the ones on my hand were the ones that stayed. I made good on my promise. For 7 years, I never said a word. I kept his secret close to my heart, like a night-blooming flower, only thinking of it when I was alone. Nick knew the truth. Nick held the key. For all that time, I wondered where the days had taken him, and if he ever thought of that little Irish girl he carried from the poppy field. And after 7 long years, I had my reward. He found me again. If only he could find me now. There was no sound from the lower floor. As the hours ticked away, I listened for a footstep, or the echoing melody of the gramophone. All I could hear was the same thick silence. I fell into a light sleep for the rest of the daylight hours. Fever burned through me, a remnant of the latest flux attack. I jerked awake every so often, my eyes bursting with pictures of the past. Had I ever worn anything but these tunics, these boots? Had I ever known a world in which there were no spirits, no wandering dead, no Emim, no Rephaim? A knock woke me. I barely had time to grab a sheet before Warden entered the room. There was not long before the bell. He placed a fresh uniform on the end of the bed. Get dressed. I looked at him in silence. His gaze lingered for a moment before he left, closing the door behind him. There was nothing for it. I got up, smoothed my curls into a knot, and washed myself with icy water. I pulled on my uniform and zipped the gilet to my chin. My leg seemed to have healed. Warden was leafing through a dusty novel when I came into the chamber. Frankenstein. Cyan didn't allow that kind of fantastical literature. Nothing with monsters or ghosts. Nothing unnatural. My fingers twitched, aching to reach out and turn its pages. I'd seen it on Jackson's bookshelf, but never found time to read it. Warden put the book aside and stood. Are you ready? Yes, I said.
Good.
He paused, then asked.
Tell me, Paige, what does your dreamscape look like?
The directness of his question took me by surprise. It was considered rude among Voyans to ask.
A field of red flowers.
What kind of flowers?
Poppies.
No response. He reached for his gloves, pulled them on, and led me from the room. The day bell hadn't chimed, but the porter let us pass without question. Nobody questioned Arcturus Mazartan.
Sunlight. I hadn't seen it for a while.
The sun was just setting, softening the edges of the buildings. Chill One glowed in a dwindling haze. I'd thought we would be training indoors, but Warden led me north, past Amarotic House and into unknown territory. The buildings in the furthest reaches of the city had all been abandoned. They were dilapidated, with windows broken. Some of the walls and roofs looked scorched. Maybe there really had been fires here once. We passed a tight-packed street of houses. It was a ghost town. No living people whatsoever. I could sense spirits nearby, bitter spirits that wanted their lost homes back. Some were weak poltergeists. I was wary, but Warden didn't seem afraid. None of them came near him. We reached the very edge of the city. My breath smoked from between my lips. A meadow stretched as far as I could see. The grass was long since dead, and the ground glistened with frost.
Strange, for early spring.
A fence had been put up around it, at least 30 feet high, topped with coils of barbed wire. Behind the fence were trees,
needled with soft rhyme. They grew around the edges of the meadow, blocking my view of the world beyond. A rusted notice read, Port Meadow, for training purposes only. Use of deadly force is authorized. Standing at the gate was the deadly force itself, a ref male. He wore his golden hair in a tight ponytail. Beside him stood a thin, dirty figure with a shaved head. Ivy, the palmist. She wore a yellow tunic, the mark of a coward. It was torn from the neck, exposing her bony shoulder to the cold. I caught sight of her brand. 20-59-24. Warden stepped forward, and I followed. Seeing us, Ivy's keeper swept into a bow.
"Behold the royal concubine," he said. "What brings you to Port Meadow?"
At first I thought he was talking to me. I'd never heard refs speak to each other with such disgust. Then I realized he was glaring at my keeper.
"I am here to instruct my human."
Warden was looking at the meadow.
"Open the gate, Thuban."
"Patience, concubine. Is it armed?"
He meant me, the human.
"No," Warden said. "She is not."
"Number?" 20-59-40.
"Age?"
He glanced at me.
19,
I said.
"Is it sighted?" "These questions are irrelevant, Thuban. I do not appreciate being treated like a child, especially not by a child."
Thuban just looked at him. He was in his late 20s by my reckoning. Certainly not a child. Neither of their faces showed any hint of anger. Their words were enough.
"You have 3 hours before Pleione brings her herd."
He shoved the gate open.
"If Forty tries to escape, it will be shot on sight. And if you ever disrespect your elders in that manner again, you will be sequestered on sight."
"The Blood Sovereign would not allow it."
"She would not have to know.
Such an accident is not too hard to conceal."
Warden towered over him.
"I do not fear your Sargus name. I am the Blood Consort, and I will exercise the power that befits my station. Do I make myself clear, Thuban?"
Thuban looked up at him, his eyes roaring blue.
"Yes," he said in a whisper. "Blood Consort."
Warden walked past him. I had no idea what to make of their exchange, but it was fairly satisfying to see a Sargus get a verbal slating. As I followed Warden through the gate, Thuban struck Ivy across the face. Her head snapped around. Her eyes were dry, but her face was swollen and discolored, and she was thinner than before. Blood and dirt streaked her arms. She was being kept in her own filth. I remember Seb looking at me that way, like all the hope in the world had crumbled. For Seb, for Ivy, for the ones who would follow, I would make this training session count. Port Meadow was vast. Warden took long strides, too long for me to keep up. I trudged behind him, trying to work out the dimensions of the meadow. It was difficult in the waning light, but I could see the ugly fences on either side, dividing the beaten ground into several large arenas. They were strung with thin wires, lined with icicles. The posts were curved towards the top. Some bore heavy brackets, each dripping a lantern. A watchtower stood on the western side, and I could just see a human, or ref, inside it. We walked past a shallow pool of water. Its frozen surface was smooth as a mirror, perfect for scrying. Come to think of it, everything about this meadow was perfect for spirit combat. The ground was solid, the air clean and fresh, and they were spirits. I could sense them everywhere, all around me. I wondered what kind of fence enclosed this meadow. Could they have worked out a way to trap spirits? No. Spirits might sometimes breach meat space, but they were not subject to physical restrictions. Only binders could trap them. Their order, the Fifth Order, could bend the limits between meat space and ether. "The fences are not charged with electricity," Warden saw where I was looking, "but with ethereal energy." "How is that possible?"
"Ethereal batteries. A fusion of refite and human expertise, pioneered in 2045.
Your scientists have been working on hybrid technology since the early 20th century. We simply replace the chemical energy in a battery with a captive poltergeist, a spirit that can interact with the corporeal world. It creates a field of repulsion. But poltergeists can escape their bindings, I said. How could you capture one? Use a willing poltergeist, of course. I stared at his back. The words willing and poltergeist were as opposite as war and peace. Our council also led to the invention of Fluxion 14 and radiothesic detection technology, he said, the latter of which remains experimental. From our last reports, we hear Cyan is close to perfecting it. I clenched my fist. Of course the Rephaim were responsible for RDT. Danny had always wondered how they'd managed it. After a while, Warden stopped. We had come to a concrete oval, 10 feet across. A gas lamp flared to life nearby. Let us begin, he said. I waited. With no warning, he aimed a mock punch at my face. I ducked. When he jabbed his other fist, I blocked it with my arm. Again. He was faster this time, trying to make me defend myself, quickly, from all angles. I kept my hands open and blocked each hit. You learn to fight in the streets. Maybe, I said. Once more, try and stop me. This time he made as if to grab my neck, placing both hands high on my décolletage. A flimp had tried this on me once. I twisted my body to the left and thrust my right arm in the same direction, cutting his hands away from my throat. I could feel the strength in those hands, but he let go. I brought my elbow against his cheek, a move that had knocked the flimp right into the gutter. He was letting me win. Excellent. Warden stepped back. Few humans come here prepared to be part of a penal battalion. You are several steps ahead of most, but you will not be able to engage in that sort of scrap with an emite. Your most important asset is your ability to affect the ether. I spied the silver glint. There was a blade in his hand. My muscles tensed rigid. From what I have seen, your gift is triggered by danger. He leveled the blade at my chest. Demonstrate. My heart pounded at the tip of his blade. I don't know how. I see. With a flick of his wrist, he brought the blade against my throat. My body hummed with adrenaline. Warden leaned in very close to me. This blade has been used to draw human blood, he said very softly. Blood like that of your friend Sebastian. I trembled. It calls for more. The blade slid along my neck. It has never tasted the blood of a dreamer. I'm not afraid of you. The tremor in my voice betrayed the lie. Don't touch me. But he did. The blade traced my throat, trailed up to my chin and touched my lips. I jerked my fist up, shoved his hand away. He dropped the blade, took my wrists in one hand and pinned them to the concrete. His strength was incredible. I couldn't move a muscle. I wonder, he used the knife to tip my chin up. If I cut your throat, how long will it take for you to die? You wouldn't, I said, daring him. Oh, but I would. I tried to wrench my knee into his groin, but he grabbed my thigh, forcing my leg down. That leg was still weak. It was easy. He was making me look feeble. When I pulled a hand free, he twisted my arm behind my back. Not hard enough to hurt, but enough to immobilize me. You will always lose that way, he said against my ear. Play to your strengths. Was there no weak spot on this creature? I thought of all the vulnerable places on a human. Eyes, kidneys, solar plexus, nose, groin. Nothing within my reach. I would have to move and run. I pushed my weight backwards, straight between his legs, and rolled back to my feet in one movement. In the instant he took to stand, I tore into a sprint across the meadow. If he wanted me, he could damn well come and get me. There was nowhere to run. He was gaining on me. Thinking back to my training sessions with Nick, I changed direction. Then I was running again, into the darkness. Away from the watchtower. There had to be a weak point in a fence like this. Somewhere I could squeeze between the wires.
Then I had to deal with Thuban. But I had my spirit. I could do it. I could do it.
For someone with excellent visual acuity, I could be incredibly short-sighted. Within a minute, I was lost. Away from the concrete oval and the lamps, I was left to stumble through the vastness of the meadow, and Warden was out there, hunting me. I ran towards a gas lamp. My sixth sense quivered as I drew nearer to the fence. By the time I was 6 feet away, I was nauseous, my limbs limp and heavy. But I had to try. I grabbed the frozen wire. I can't fully describe the sensation that seized my body. My vision turned black, then white, then red. Goosebumps broke out all over me. 100 memories flashed before my eyes. Memories of a scream in a poppy field, and new memories too. The Geist's memories. It was a murder victim. A deafening bang shook my every bone. My stomach gave an almighty heave. I hit the ground and retched. I must have stayed there for a minute, racked by pictures of blood on a cream carpet. This person had been killed with a shotgun. His skull had burst open, spraying brain and shattered bone. My ears rang. When I came to my senses, my body felt uncoordinated. I dragged myself along the ground, blinking away bloody visions. A silver-white burn slashed across my palm, the mark of a poltergeist. Something shot past my ear. I looked up to see another watchtower, and the guard standing inside it. Flux dart. A second dart fired in my direction. I scrambled to my feet, turned east and ran. But soon enough I came to another watchtower, and another gun had me running south. It was only when I saw the oval that I realized I was being driven back to Warden. The next dart hit me in the shoulder. The pain was instant and excruciating. I reached up and tore the thing out. Blood flowed from the wound, and a wave of disorientating nausea swept over me. I was fast enough to stop the drug. It took about 5 seconds to self-inject. But the message was clear. Get back on the oval, or get shot. Warden was waiting for me. Welcome back. I swiped the sweat from my forehead. So I'm not allowed to run. No. Unless you would like me to present you with a yellow tunic, which we give only to cowards. I ran at him, blinded by anger, and drove my shoulder into his abdomen. Given his size, nothing happened. He just took me by the tunic and tossed me away. I landed hard on the same shoulder. You cannot fight me with your bare hands. He prowled the edge of the oval. Nor can you run from an emite. You are a dreamwalker, girl. You have the power to live and die as you decree. Lay waste to my dreamscape. Drive me mad. A part of me tore away. My spirit flew across the space between us. It slashed through the outer ring of his mind, like a knife through taut silk. I broke through the darkest part of his dreamscape, straining against impossibly powerful barriers, aiming for the distant patch of light that was his sunlit zone, but it wasn't as easy as it had been on the train. The center of his dreamscape was so far away, and my spirit was already being driven out. Like an elastic band stretched too far, I snapped back into my own mind, the weight of my own spirit knocking me off my feet. My head rapped against the concrete. The gas lamp swam back into focus. I pushed myself up on my elbows, my temples throbbing. Warden was still standing. I hadn't brought him to his knees, as I had with Aludra, but I had tampered with his perception. He ran a hand over his face and shook his head. Good, he said. Very good. I stood. My legs shook. You're trying to make me angry, I said. Why? It seems to work. He pointed the blade. Again. I looked up at him, trying to catch my breath. Again? You can do better than that. You barely touched my defenses. I want you to make a dent. I can't do it again. Black spotted my vision. It doesn't work like that. Why not? Because it stops me breathing. Have you never gone swimming? What? The average human can hold their breath for at least 30 seconds without causing lasting damage.
That is more than enough time for you to attack another mind and return to your body. I'd never thought of it like that. Nick had always ensured I use life support when I sense the ether at a distance. Think of your spirit as a muscle, tearing from its natural place, Warden said. The more you use it, the stronger and faster it will become, and the better your body will cope with the repercussions. You will be able to jump quickly between dreamscapes, before your body hits the ground.
You don't know anything, I said.
Nor do you.
I suspect the incident on the train was the first time you ever walked in another dreamscape.
He didn't move the blade.
Walk in mine. I challenge you.
I searched his face. He was inviting me to come into his mind, to wound his sanity.
You don't really care. You're just training me, I said.
We circled each other.
Nishira asked you to choose me. I know what she wants.
No, I chose you. I laid claim to your instruction. And the last thing I want, he stepped towards me, is for you to embarrass me with your incompetence.
His eyes were hard as flint.
Attack me again, and do it properly this time.
No,
I'd call his bluff.
Let him be embarrassed. Let him be as mortified by me as my father. I'm not going to kill myself just so you can get a gold star from Nishira.
You want to hurt me, he said, softer now.
You loathe me. You resent me. He lifted the knife. Destroy me.
At first I did nothing. Then I remember the hours I'd spent cleaning his arm, and how he'd threatened me. I remembered how he'd stood aside and watched Seb die. I flung my spirit back at him. In the time we spent on that meadow, I barely fractured his dreamscape. Even when he dropped most of his defenses, I couldn't get any further than his hadal zone. His mind was just too strong. He goaded me the whole time. He told me I was weak, that I was pathetic, that I was a disgrace to all clairvoyance, that it was no wonder humans were good for nothing but slavery. Did I want to live in a cage, like an animal? He was happy to oblige. At first the provocation did its job, but the more the night wore on, the less his insults roused me. In the end they were just frustrating, not enough to force my spirit out. That was when he threw a blade. He aimed well away from me, but the sight of the flying knife was enough to set my spirit loose. Each time I did, my body fell. If my foot so much as slipped off the oval, a flux dart came whistling in my direction. I soon learned to premeditate the sound, and to duck before the needle could hit home. I managed 5 or 6 jumps out of my body. Each time was like having my head ripped open. Finally, I could take no more. My vision went double, and a migraine swelled above my left eye. I bent at the waist, hungry for air. Don't show weakness, don't show weakness. My knees were going to give. Warden knelt in front of me and wrapped an arm around my waist. I tried to push him away, but my arms were like string.
Stop, he said. Stop resisting.
He lifted me into his arms. I'd never experienced this quick fire jumping. I didn't know if my brain would stand it. The backs of my eyes throbbed. I couldn't look at the lantern.
You did well.
Warden looked down at me. But you could do much better. I couldn't reply.
Paige?
I'm fine. My voice was slurred. He seemed to take my word for it. Still holding me, he made his way towards the gate. Warden set me on my feet again after a while. We walked in silence back to the entrance, where Thuban had left his post. Ivy was sitting against the fence, her face in her hands, her shoulders shaking. When we approached the sallyport, she stood and undid the bolt. Warden glanced at her as we passed.
Thank you, Ivy.
She looked up. There were tears in her eyes. When was the last time she'd been called by her real name? Warden kept his silence as we walked through the ghost town. I was only half awake. Nick would have made me rest in bed for hours if I'd been with him, and scolded me for good measure. It was only when we walked past Amarotic House that Warden spoke again.
Do you often try to sense the ether at a distance?
None of your business, I said.
Your eyes hold death. Death and ice.
He turned to face me.
Strange, when they burn so hot in your anger. I met his gaze.
Your eyes change too.
Why do you think that might be?
I don't know. I don't know anything about you.
That is true enough.
Warden looked me up and down.
Show me your hand.
After a moment, I showed him my right hand. The burn had taken on an ugly, nacreous appearance. He took out a tiny vial of liquid from his pocket, tipped it against his gloved finger, and spread its contents over the mark. Before my eyes, it melted away, leaving no trace. I pulled my hand back.
How did you do that?
It is called amaranth. He put the vial away, then looked back at me.
Tell me, Paige, are you afraid of the ether?
No, I said. My palm tingled.
Why not?
It was a lie. I was afraid of the ether. When I pushed my sixth sense too far, I ran the risk of death, or at least brain injury. Jax had told me from the beginning that if I worked for him, I was likely to cut my lifespan by about 30 years, maybe more. It all rested on luck.
Because the ether is perfect, I said. There's no war, there's no death, because everything there is already dead. And there's no sound, just silence and safety.
Nothing is safe in the ether. And even the ether is not exempt from war and death. I studied his profile as he looked at the black sky. His breath didn't cloud in the cold, not like mine. But for a moment, just the briefest moment, there was something human in his face. Something pensive, almost bitter. Then he turned to face me again, and it was gone. Something was amiss outside the rookery. A group of red jackets were crouched on the cobblestones, watched by silent Harleys, talking in quick, hushed voices. I glanced up at Warden to see if he was concerned. If he was, he didn't show it. He walked towards the group, causing most of the Harleys to shrink back into their shacks. What is it? One of the red jackets looked up, saw who had spoken, and flicked his gaze back down. His tunic was caked in mud.
We were in the woods, he said, his voice hoarse. We got lost. The MM, they...
Warden's hand strayed to his forearm. The red jackets were gathered around a boy of perhaps 16. His entire right hand was missing, and it wasn't just his tunic that was red. My mouth clenched up. His hand had been ripped and twisted from his arm, as if it had been caught in a machine. Warden analyzed the scene with no hint of emotion.
You say you were lost, he said. Which keeper was with you?
The Blood Heir. Warden leveled his gaze on the street.
I should have known.
My eyes burned on his back. He was just standing there. The red jacket was trembling uncontrollably, his face shining with sweat. He was going to die if someone didn't bandage the stump, or at least get a blanket over him.
Take him to Oriel.
Warden turned away from the group. Terrabel will deal with him. The rest of you, get back to your residences. The amaurotics will tend to your wounds. I looked at his hard-bitten features, searching for a hint of something warm. I found nothing. He didn't care. I didn't know why I kept looking. The red jackets lifted their friend and staggered towards an alleyway, leaving spots of blood in their wake.
He needs a hospital, I made myself say it. You've got no idea how to. He will be dealt with.
He was silent then, and his eyes grew hard. I guessed that meant I'd overstepped the line. But I was starting to wonder where exactly the line had been drawn. Warden never beat me. He let me sleep. He used my real name when we were alone. He had even let me attack his mind, made himself vulnerable to my spirit, a spirit that could break his very sanity apart. I couldn't understand why he would take the risk. Even Nick was wary of my gift.
Call it a healthy respect, Sotnos.
As we headed towards the residence, I let my hair down from its knot. I almost jumped out of my body again when someone else's hands took over, pulling my damp curls around my shoulders.
Ah, 2040, a pleasure to see you again.
The voice was tinged with amusement, high-pitched for a man.
I must congratulate you, Warden. She looks even more ravishing in a tunic.
I turned to face the man behind me. It took effort not to recoil. It was the medium, the one that had chased me across the rooftops of 1-5, but he wasn't carrying a flux gun tonight. He wore a strange uniform in the colors of Cyan. Even his face matched the color code. Red mouth, black eyebrows, face dusted with zinc oxide. He was probably in his late 30s, and he carried a heavy leather whip. I was sure I could see blood on it. This must be the overseer, the man who kept the Harleys in check. Behind him was the oracle from the first night. He looked at me with disconcerting eyes, one dark and piercing, one clear hazel. His tunic was the same color as mine. Warden looked down at them. What do you want, overseer?
Pardon my intrusion. I merely wanted to see the dreamer again. I have watched her progress with great interest.
She is not a performer. Her progress is not for watching.
Indeed. But what a charming sight it is. He flashed me a smile. Allow me to welcome you personally to Shield One. I'm Beltrame, the overseer. I hope my flux dart didn't scar your back.
I reacted. I couldn't help it.
If you hurt my father.
I did not give you permission to speak, 2040.
Warden stared me down. The overseer laughed, patted my cheek. I jerked away from him.
There now. Your father is safe and well.
He made a sign on his chest. Cross my heart. I should have been relieved, but all I could feel was anger at his nerve. Warden looked at the younger man.
Who is this?
This is 2059-12.
The overseer placed a hand on his shoulder.
He is a very loyal servant to Pliny. He has done exceptionally well in his studies over the last few weeks.
I see. Warden's eyes flicked over him, assessing his aura. You are an oracle, boy.
Yes, Warden.
12 bowed.
The Blood Sovereign must be pleased with your progress.
We have had no oracle since Bone Season 16.
I hope to be among those in a service soon, Warden.
There were traces of the North in his accent.
As you will be, 12.
You'll do very well against your Emmite, I think.
12 is about to take a second test,
the overseer said. We were just on our way back to Merton to join the rest of his battalion. Pliny and Al-Safi will lead them.
Are the Swolosin aware of the injured Red Jacket?
Warden said.
Yes. They hunt the same Emmite that bit him.
Warden's expression flickered.
The best of luck to you in that endeavor, 12,
he said.
12 bowed again. But I do have another reason to interrupt before we leave, the overseer said. I am here to extend an invitation to the Dreamwalker, if I may.
Warden turned to face him. The overseer took a silence as permission to continue.
We are putting on a very special celebration in honor of this Bone Season 2040, the 20th Bone Season.
He swept a hand towards the rookery.
Our finest performers, a feast for the senses. A saturnalia of music and dancing to show off all our boys and girls.
You refer to the Bicentenary, Warden said. It was the first time I'd heard the word.
Precisely, the overseer smiled. The ceremony during which the Great Territorial Act will be signed.
That didn't sound good. Before I could hear any more, I was blinded by a vision. As an oracle, Nick could send soundless images through the ether. He called them prismi, a Greek word. I could never pronounce it, so I just called them snapshots. 12 had the same gift. I saw a clock, both hands pointing towards 12, followed by 4.